Welcome to the M&M Revolution. I'm Renee, and today with me I have Craig. Welcome, Craig.
I'm the green M&M. How are you doing, Renee?
I'm good. We've had dinner. We're weirdly in a hotel room.
The size of a shoebox.
I've had my semi-vegan dinner, and now we're eating M&Ms.
Correction, you're eating my M&Ms.
Yeah, good point. I'm hitting your M&Ms.
Welcome. Been a while since we've done a podcast, Renee, because I think there's about 47 of them sitting on the cutting room floor. We can't seem to be able to record remotely, so that's why we have to sit in the hotel room. And
now we're having posting problems.
Yes. I have a machine in the back of me trying to post something from the archive. Let's call it the archive. That sounds like a nice way of saying...
The backlog?
Something really, really old, yes.
Of which, you know, in fairness, we don't have too many in WIP processing-wise.
No, zero WIP.
One.
Yeah, okay, one, yeah. Anyway, lots happening in the Agile world since we last spoken. You know, new frameworks have come out, new certifications have come out. Lots of stuff, really, but a lot of nothing, really.
Oh, okay, well, guess we're done then?
We are. Thanks for listening to the Agile Revolution. I guess the thing for me, though, since you know, I don't know about you, but I'm kind of sensing this wave of organisations now that, you know, whilst there's always been, you know, people sort of trying stuff out, just in the last probably 3 to 6 months, the amount of organisations that I would have checked off my list as, you know, would never go agile or would be the last bastion of moving across are starting to make the leap, which is really interesting times.
So that's a whole crossing the chasm debate, and I think a lot of that comes down to some organisations having success or being seen to have success utilising Agile, and it's, oh, we better catch up, we better play this game, or maybe even be seen to be playing this game. So it sort of concerns me that there's a lot of people doing Agile, but if I had to talk about organisations that I feel are really working hard to be agile, there's very few out there, and the numbers are extremely low in the Southern Hemisphere. So I think there's a great opportunity to have someone step up and go, look, we're going to lead the way in Australia, and we're going to show you everyone how it's done.
But do we run the risk, though, that, because I agree with you, we've crossed that chasm of I'll dip my toe in the water and give this a go, either because necessity, because there is so much disruption in different industries, or by, hey, I'm the last person standing over here on the other side, you know, I'll come over because the water seems good over there. Do we start to run the risk, though, that because people haven't fully unlocked the potential, because they fully haven't understood the cultural impact, they fully haven't understood the change that they need to go through to, I guess, to be better, do we now start to run the risk, perhaps, that people might actually default back to something else? I'm not sure it's waterfall, but... is there some sort of, you know, middle ground where people go, you know what, we're happy with slow?
I don't know whether... I don't think it will regress to that extent, and certainly there's been many instances of organisations that have gotten rid of Agile, and what I typically see in a lot of those organisations is they end up doing it by stealth. So whilst management has said, get this thing out of here, you end up having a lot of teams who are doing, I guess, undercover-based Agile and not telling their leaders, and their leaders are magically going, why is this team over here working and these ones aren't?
They're doing undercover-based waterfall as well, though.
Yeah, it's a fair call. I think that's probably true. I think where I see organisations potentially going is more in that business agility space. So, yeah, I agree. I think Agile will probably die at some point in time as a term or as a function. However, I am in hope that organisations will strive for just general business agility.
I think you hit the nail on the head, because we got the whole debate about software is done, really. We've taken that to a pretty decent level with all the tooling and all the technology and the techniques we have there. The problem is that it's no good if you can produce a whole bunch of stuff really quickly that either can't go anywhere or people are too afraid to actually send to the backlog in the first place.
Yeah, so if you think about the end-to-end customer value stream or the enterprise business value stream, when we start to deliver in Agile, a lot of the focus from a bottom-up sort of level is just a tiny portion of that end-to-end value stream, and we're just making that little bit faster. So business agility is really more around the complete picture of understanding our customer and getting the ideas out of them into delivery, into production, operationalizing it. So recently it was interesting, I was doing some thought processes in my head around minimal viable. And there's obviously this huge language going on inside of Australia, minimal viable product. It seems to be the trend word of this year and of last year. And everyone
must be written in an airline magazine.
Everyone just throws it out there, minimal viable product. And I think like 50% of them actually know what it is. And then if you ask people for a true definition, maybe you're lucky if you get 5% who actually know what it truly is.
So, Renee, what is the definition of minimal viable product?
Well, officially it would be the minimal amount of work to get the maximum amount of validated learnings.
Very good.
On the spot. Oh my God, I'm not drunk yet. I still need to eat some M&Ms though, so crunch, crunch. But it's interesting to me because that's great for lean startups. And so for the disrupting organisations, they've got a really great simple framework. And I think the challenge for enterprises inside of Australia, is more around... They can't ever work necessarily, I think, in that true lean startup fashion. And there's a number of reasons why. They're out there, they've got brand, they've got compliance that they need to align with. There's a lot of reputational risk associated with what they're doing. So I've started looking at patterns of enterprises implementing lean startup to see what the life cycle is, because MVP is not it. It's not enough. It's the starting point. It's the starting discussion. Get that minimal out there. Generally, in enterprises, that product is not going out to real customers. It's going to, in enterprises, customers inside of that enterprise. So people who work in that area who are starting to test it because it's a safe group.
Mm.
You're not going to risk the brand as a result of that. And so they're getting that feedback from them. And then the next stage after minimal viable product is minimal viable experience. So getting enough product out there that given their branding, customers is going, yeah, that's up to scratch. That's the sort of quality that we're expecting from this big tier organization.
But I take that point. So if we roll back to what you're saying about lean startup, I agree with you because if you're a startup, you don't have a product, you don't necessarily have a reputation, you may have a small group of people who are really keen for that particular product.
Your safety to fail is higher.
And as well as your ability to fund the initiative, is a lot lower.
Yeah.
However, one of the problems that enterprises fall into is that they treat every new initiative like a project, like it's something brand
Agreed.
New.
Yep.
When in actual fact, 99%, maybe that's a too big a number, let's just say 85 to 90%, of the things that most large enterprises do are just a reworking of something they already have. Right, a slight variation of a product, but it's only when you're actually going into new territory, right? Brand new product, brand new customer base, brand new. Other than that, a lot of it's just tweaking the same things that they already do.
Yeah, yes and no. I think certainly to some extent, I'd say in a lot of the digital sphere inside of enterprise products, they're not just. I wouldn't say it's a tweaking. I think it's a realization of potentially new personas. So a lot of these products isn't just.
But then the risks aren't big because those personas, we take the example of a large bank that you used to work for, and we take initiatives that they would did in their digital side, things like being able to go to an ATM and take money out without having a card, for example. Right, that's an example of a lean startup initiative.
Yeah.
But that was really to attract people who weren't at that organisation. If it happened to attract people who are already there, then so be it. So therefore, the risk is not that great because it's a small subset of a feature in a larger product to attract a customer base that they actually don't have yet.
I agree. However, if it failed, there was a big impact onto the organisation.
How so?
Depends on the focus, but in this instance, we're talking about wanting to be seen as an innovator and wanting to be seen to produce good quality outcomes and wanting to be seen to meet needs that others are not meeting.
But we can take that organization or others in that banking sphere, and there's been plenty of innovative solutions that have never really hit the mark. That's an example of one that people remember because it was innovative. So I still think the risk was low, because if nobody knew about it, then nobody knew about it. In other words, it wasn't something anybody wanted.
And I think this goes to the point where I haven't quite finished the MV route, because it's minimal...
Well, it's just like you get the M&M down, so then you can get there.
Thank you. So it's like minimal viable product, minimal viable experience. So what a customer would expect from that. I think the next stage from what I've actually seen is minimal viable robustness. So once...
Are you making up terms?
I'm not. Well... I've basically
put a hashtag in front of this, and I'm going to be very upset, young lady.
I'm re-clarifying a blog post in my head that I've done, but in essence, taking a look at, is this product able to scale now that we know that we've got something that's of customer value for a particular need for a customer that's meeting their experience expectations. So what I have found in a lot of these places is it's get the product out there, but as soon as the numbers start going up, you need to really quickly start to put some features in there that actually gives that robustness, that scalability, that performance and that reliability. So then once you get to that level, then they generally go minimal marketable product. So, and that's when they market.
So how does that differ to a minimal marketable feature then, Ray?
Well, a minimal marketable feature would be potentially down to that fifth route, which is more a continuously improved product. So once all of those four levels are done, you've got a product out there, we know it meets a need, we know it's got the right levels of experience, we know it scales and robust, and we've advertised it to the world, then it's a continuously evolving product.
Mm-hmm.
So it's my first non-MV, continuously evolving product. And a lot of people miss the fact that this is... not something that we just, as a project, to your point earlier, going to say implement and then sort of move off. This is something that we're continually evolving from that point.
But doesn't this bring you back to the whole argument that in order to move from a traditional way of working to a more agile way of working, we have to remove ourselves of some of these long-standing traditions and, you know, things like, you know, no projects or this whole idea of moving more towards a product-centric model as to a project-centric model are kind of key to large enterprises being able to adopt this? Because if you're treating everything like a project, spin up, spin down, there's no continuous evolution because you don't know when the next evolution will be.
Yeah, so I think it's well aligned with some of the viewpoints when I start looking at the enterprise transformation meta model, which says, you know, transformations happen in many different ways. A lot of transformations happen bottom up from the team upwards sort of level. But in order to have a true enterprise transformation, then you're looking at not just team transformation, not just governance, but how you finance the work, and then obviously how you go and finance and govern the people. There are very few, and when I talk about true enterprise agility and the mark that we're not really hitting inside of Australia right now, we're not tackling the finance, we're not tackling the HR groups or the org structure in a lot of cases. And certainly when I'm thinking in enterprise, I'm talking like 30,000 plus sized organisations.
Which comes back to your original point of business agility.
Yeah.
Which is past just, you know, racking out code. It's you know, I always go back to the water scrum form model, but I think it says it eloquently, is that that's fixing the water problem that...
Yeah,
from the business case, we need to start thinking differently and start
that end to end value stream. Yeah,
speeding up end to end and not, you know, throwing that blame down the line at IT or whatever, you know procurement or whatever, real estate or whatever project team is actually down the end of the line.
But I think the difference is it's not just about how we deliver work or the work that we deliver, and it's not that end to end value stream, but it's also everything to do with the people and the environment and the technology that underpins all of that as well.
So then what, in your opinion, makes that agile?
Yeah, it's interesting. So at what point are you agile? I got into a bit of a quandary probably about 4 months ago, sort of nutting that in my head and going, oh, is it like a lean true north?
It's a recursive loop in your brain, isn't it?
Yeah, I think it's a true north sort of concept. Mm. So I don't know... in fairness, if you ever do get there.
I think that's okay.
Yeah.
That's the whole argument about whether agile will ever be done, and I don't think it ever will be done because it in itself is ever evolving.
And I think the issue is that people see coaching as a finite period of time.
Hmm.
And if I go into an organisation contractually to try and... induce a transformation, I know that it's a forever thing, and I know that I should be lifting up capability inside for them to get to the point where they know it's a forever thing.
Well, to be fair, your coaching can have a time frame on it and should have a time frame on it.
Yeah.
But the organization's learning and evolution is never a never foregone deal, because you might expire the learnings you bring to the organization when it's time to bring somebody else on to to take to the next level. It's when they actually go, yep, that's our 15 days of coaching done. Yeah, thanks for coming. Yeah.
But it's a really interesting conversation, because until they start to experience it and still they start to get it, they won't. It's not a conversation that they can actually fathom.
But do you think, this is a question I've been grappling with, do you think they actually get it? Because I still get this feeling that lots of people feel like they're okay with the status quo. And I'm starting to wonder sometimes whether, you know, if you think about things like continuous delivery, right, being able to deliver to production, even things like potentially shippable increments. Let's go right back to Scrum. And you have these arguments of people going, yeah, we don't really need to deliver every 2 weeks. We don't need to be like Facebook and deliver 10,000 times a day. And that might be okay, but where's that kind of limit? Because if you don't strive for something, particularly to be able to flip a switch when the business demand, takes hold, then what's the point?
I think the good thing is those lean startup disruptors are starting to grow inside of Australia. And whilst the appreciation that, their organisations may not be always around is starting to grow. And I think a number of large enterprises, to your point earlier around it seems to across the chasm, I think a lot of those organisations are starting to get visibility of these disruptors and are consequently getting worried. Now, the intriguing thing for me is whether they can turn around their business agility fast enough to be able to compete with these disruptors before the disruptors take out the market share.
Hmm.
So I think 5-10 years, we're going to know this answer. Intriguingly, it's the big enterprises that can pay for support, but whether they can actually get the help and they'll change in time is interesting.
Hmm. Yeah, there you go. A couple of things. We've had some mail in our mailbag.
Have we?
Yes.
Well, did you not tell me?
Yeah, I'm just throwing it at you.
Oh, okay.
A few things have been floating around. I think they're good. They're the good things to discuss while we're sitting here. We don't have a computer in front of us, so we can't go on and go
Googling anything,
such as on the fly.
Maximum minimal learnings, blah blah blah.
Yeah, everything you're hearing is on the cuff until Renee runs out of M&Ms. That's when the podcast will finish. So a couple of things have come through the mailbag. Firstly, a email I got from someone who I've been coaching recently. Their family member, I can't remember exactly what family member it was, is working in some sort of digital UX type environment, but not really on the IT side. One has heard about this Agile thing because he comes home and talks about it and says, I want to start with Agile, right? I want to do some reading. Where do I start? And I struggled with answering this question. I've got some ideas, but when someone comes to you, because they don't have necessarily a coach in their organisation, they've heard about this thing, they want to get a little more knowledgeable, besides listening to this awesome podcast, where do they go? What would you recommend, Renee?
Okay, this is going to sound really bad. Maybe not. I actually like how the Scrum Guide reads.
No,
I think it's a really simple read.
Mm.
It's
only 20 pages. Yeah,
exactly. Gives you the basics of the roles, of the process. So that would be a starting point. Oh, where would I go after that, though?
So if they were technical, I still, and we were just talking about this at dinner, I would still pick up Extreme Programming Explained.
Yep.
I know I'm showing my age and I'm showing my my bias, particularly in that, but again, it's a 160 page read. It's not a huge book.
Yep.
Has technical concepts in there, has all the Scrum things without being overloaded with Scrum, and just gets you started on that journey. So that's certainly one that, if they come from a technical angle. And when I get graduate programmers come to me, I typically recommend the Extreme Programming Explained book, and I typically recommend the Pragmatic Programmer. Again, quite old book, but from the point of view of getting your head into the space of being a good software engineer, nothing really agile too much in that book, but certainly use the values that helps you work on an agile team. They're the two that I tell them to start with.
Scrum Master's probably Gil Broz's book. The Agile Leader.
Agile Culture, was it? Agile.
Sorry, Gil.
Yeah, if we had a computer, we'd look that up. why that book? I haven't read that book.
It's really just basic. This is what it's like to be a Scrum Master, what it's like to be a servant leader. It goes through a lot of the basics about how to be a Scrum Master without necessarily going on a CSM course, and gives you a lot more depth to add on to the Scrum Guide in itself.
I think the I quite like from the Kanban side, personal Kanban, like if someone is actually just thinking about Agile in general, and sometimes they're not even thinking about how they move it on to their team, sometimes just starting with yourself is a really good place to start. Team one, I'm awesome. So I think the personal Kanban book is a quite accessible book from that perspective. And if you do want to start with your team, then I still like the Kanban Action book that I've spoken about on previous podcasts. And one of these days we do have an interview with the author of that book, Marcus, coming up. But very accessible book, from hey, you're not doing nothing, you're not doing anything, to hey, you can actually start to organise your work.
And I think at a portfolio level, Kenny Rubin's Essential Scrum, is probably the go-to book at that level as well. So if you want to know more about how this sort of scales up, or some of the key project-related, or not even project, because he talks really about component versus feature teams, product-centric versus product-centric, I think it does a lot of good at that ground level on that transition as well.
Mm. But product owners, where would they go?
I really don't know.
So, I think it was Roman Pitchler. I'm pretty sure he wrote a book. Certainly had a series of articles on the product owner. I'm sure he wrote a book. But that's probably where I'd go for that role. And that's actually one of the few where I actually...
Is there a gap there?
I think so. Certainly, the other one that I would strongly recommend to pick up is Jeff Patton's User Story Mapping. As much as it's not a... It is about owning the product. So Roman's stuff on what a product owner is, and Jeff's stuff on
how to
design good products, I think is where I'd go in that space.
Yeah, Jeff's book did come to mind, but I thought more for people who are writing stories and starting to flesh the work out, but that would suit a product owner very well. Yes.
Just some going through the roles. What about a business analyst?
Well,
if you're talking about gaps, I mean, you can go all the way back to Mike Cohen's User Story Applied.
You can even go even further back. You could go to Alistair Coburn's Use Cases book.
You could indeed.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. But I
learnt very, very long time ago.
I think from the point of view of an agile perspective, I think Mike's books are probably more accessible. But I also feel that that book is dated quite considerably. It has nowhere near enough in there. So for me, probably the book that probably rings true to me is the Specification by Example book by Gojko Adzik, where you really start to talk about that Three Amigos idea and collaborating around the problem.
Okay. I mean, the reason why, like, I know as much as I laughed on the use case one, like at a fundamental level, what I see a lot of BAs missing is when you start to go down and drilling into stories, that thought process behind scenario-based story development. So understanding...
But is that because we have a generation of business analysts who haven't really done business analysis?
Well, no, I don't think they've done business analysis from a decomposition perspective.
That's what I mean. Yeah. So a lot of people who have done business degrees, who understand a lot of the business side of the equation, often have IT expertise as well, and then come in and actually know the system extremely well, and have a very good communication level with the stakeholders or the customers in order to extract those. But the skills, the techniques, and the like, things like use cases, I think are things that seem to be lacking in a lot of newer business analysts I see coming through.
I mean, even if you go back to the fundamentals of that book, it's talking about who are actors and and what are the key scenarios and secondary scenarios, and mapping out the relationships between the different use cases and how they fit together. And there still was discussions even back then around effectively minimal viable sort of requirements at that point in time, and that you didn't necessarily build all your use cases on day one.
Mm.
So the thought processes were still there.
So then you go read the UML book and go and...
Yeah. Those were the days.
I saw Martin Fowler last week and he basically apologised.
Okay, UML was really hard to explain to the business. I got to admit that.
Mm. But I mean, a lot of those things still hold true. But yeah, but I think there is a little bit of a gap. I mean, I know the IIBA have done a little bit of work in that body of knowledge. I can't say I've only ever flipped through it. I've never read it cover to cover. I don't know how good or bad that is from a basis perspective. But it seems to me to be one of those, to a certain extent, forgotten roles. Because what I worry about is that business analysis role is just tarnished with being, you know, the story card people.
Well, the product owner writes the user stories, don't they?
Well, it depends which book you read.
Yeah. Yeah, so that's where I think it's also getting muddied, is who does that. And it gets interesting in an agile environment, is do you need BAs? And that's a whole other kettle of fish.
I think it comes down to that skill set, because there's no right or wrong answer. And you've got a big complex organisation, you know, like a big financial institution for a big insurance organisation. There is a real need for good analysts to try and make sense of the business domain and map that, you know, quite often back to the system. But in some organisations, that's not so required.
And it's interesting, because I've seen a trend over the last few years between having business BAs and technical BAs, and I think, what the hell's going on?
The skill of analysis is needed, right? It's needed in any team you've got, whether it's a separate individual, whether it's something being taken up by the tester or...
I'm just really worried that there just seems to be over-specialisation these days. And I was a BA, I was both technical and business. I just don't get it.
Mm.
And like, when you look down development path specialities, it's like crazy. When I was a developer, I did HTML, Java, CSS. It was, and there wasn't specializations of I'm only this sort of thing. And I know that we're breaking those boundaries back.
I think in software engineering that's certainly come back. But I do agree with you in some of the softer skills. Same with testing. We haven't talked about testing yet, but you know, testing where we've got test automators and testers. I don't get it.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Well, maybe a different topic. Let's go back to your one original one.
Well, testers is probably the last one I hadn't heard. If a tester was starting out on their journey, where would you send them in the direction of?
Well, I actually would have said specification by example originally, but...
So I think so, although that book is far less about testing than it is about collaboration. So for me, it's probably Lisa Chrisman and Janet Gregory's Agile Testing book. And
haven't read, so update, yeah, okay.
More Agile Testing, but that's probably where I would go for that.
Yep.
Hasn't been updated for a little while, but there's that top 100 Agile books. Fortunately, it hasn't been updated in like a year or two, but most of the books are in that list, particularly in the top 10. So I think Lisa Aitken's book is in there, Don Ryerson's book's in there. When you actually look at the books that, when you're starting to progress on your journey, most of the books in that top 100 are still, you know, hold pretty well true.
But it's still concerning to me that to be awesome at this, there's a lot of knowledge that you need to know. There's a lot of books. There's a lot of certifications. It's a very complex world that we've created for ourselves.
We have. So short answer is there's some books to go start with. Second thing from the mailbag, and that's a good segue you made before, is something that's been popping around on the groups is I want to get a certification. I'm a new Scrum Master. What do I do? And there's been some debate in the Australian Agile community. Well, it's a debate, but differing points of view about where do you start? Do you start with a certified Scrum Master or one of the equivalents? Do you need that if you've been playing around the Scrum field for a little while? How do we answer that question? So we've got people who are past the basics of Agile. They're playing in that Scrum Master field as a new person. And they want to put something on their resume, or they kind of don't know what they don't know. Where do they go?
So I think we need to separate the question into two, because there's a question to me around valuable things that I could learn, and there's a question around valuable things that are on my resume. And the reason why I'd separate the two is commonly a lot of resumes get first passed through HR groups. Mm-hmm. And HR groups are often told to look for certain buzzwords.
So what's the thing you're most embarrassed about in your resume, Renee?
The thing that we might end up getting to, which is I used to be a CMMI certified person, which I'm thinking pretty sure I've gotten rid of out of my resume, but it may still be there.
That's something I have to keep in the back of my memory to make fun of you on a future podcast about. Right then, okay. But yeah, I mean, but it's one of those things that if you're trying to pass through a filter of a large corporate, and that's the difference between getting the job and not getting the job.
Yeah, and I think for a lot of people who are starting out in the agile community, you sort of need to have some key certifications on your resume in order to get even a look in, which is sad, because generally when I look at resumes, I look for experience over certifications, and probably that's because of my belief system inside of certifications more than anything else. However, if you're after value adding, it depends on the provider as far as certified Scrum Master as to whether you'll get value out of that.
Yeah, because if you take the, I think it's the same for both the Scrum organisations, but each Scrum trader essentially brings their own material and their own. They pass a training certification based on, you know, showing that they have knowledge.
But isn't that every certification?
No, some of them are more stringent around the actual material. I mean,
that's right. SAFE is stringent around the material.
You actually get the material and have to train to that, yep. Which has its pros and cons. Yep. You have, you know, bringing your own material has its pros and cons, yep. and sometimes just certifying the trainer has pros and cons. So there's no perfect answer to the system as far as I'm aware of. But the appeal of certified Scrum Master, you've got a CSM, I've got a CSM, Tony's got a CSM. Hey, Tony.
Who's Tony?
I don't know, some guy who pops up on the podcast occasionally. Every podcast we do with him ends up on the cutting room floor, so that's probably why you're hearing this one and not the others. He lives on an island with not very good internet. It's one of those things that... I mean, why did you go and get your CSM in the first place?
I didn't feel I needed it at the time. I even didn't feel that my resume needed it. There was part of in the back of my head knowing that HR people would pass over to see that it was there. I had been doing Agile for, I think, 4 or 5 years by the time that I did a CSM. I think the intriguing factor for me was that Jeff Sutherland was in the country at the time, and thought if I'm going to hear it from anybody, I'd probably prefer to hear it from him. And the irony is that a lot of people that were in that room were people that I've trained as well. So it was interesting. It was a little bit awkward because I thought, I wonder if I've been teaching them the right thing. And the good news is the feedback that I got from them is, you covered the basics really well. Didn't really feel like we learned anything new from Jeff. And said that I was a better trainer, but aside from that,
just to be clear though, we're talking about, you know, mid 2000s.
Oh, this is a long time ago. Yeah,
not like you did it yesterday.
No.
Yeah, I mean, I did mine. As we've mentioned before, I did mine with Gabrielle Benefield from Yahoo. Again, I was just waiting for someone who knew it, and I'd been playing around being a what we were calling an iteration manager for so long that when I saw this course, I went, I wonder if I've been doing this right, because there was no books. You know, when we started, there was... You know,
2 books.
Yeah, 2 or 3 books and a blog post, and that was about it.
Mm.
And just to hear from somebody else, and I learned nothing on that course about Scrum. I learned everything about what the rest of the world was doing, because it opened up. It opened up I remember that course was when I learned about Kanban. I remember catching up with Gabrielle after the course, and she went, have you been following that brand new Google group or brand new Yahoo group about this thing called Kanban? I went, Kanban, and I remember writing it down on a post-it note and going home and typing that in and going, well, that's interesting.
A few years later, I'd tell you about Kanban and you go, I wrote something down about that, but I never really looked into it.
I did look into it at the time, but the thing was though that it was just a group of people chatting about something, and all they were talking about was, you know, continuous flow and a few things of that. And I went, I don't get it, because there was nothing really to hold on to, because they had they actually had the IP. They, you know, things like whip limits. If I hadn't been following that whole track through, it wasn't there. So I'm just looking at going, they're moving stuff across the wall. I don't get it. Because it, you know, it was point in time. That's the problem with the marketing group.
Yeah.
And it wasn't really until the Blue Book came out.
Mm.
Or for me, more important, probably when Henry Nyberg's book came out, was probably when I really started to take notice of it. And then finally when I think, when you actually came back and went, we should really be having a closer look at this, that, you know, probably really forced me down the track.
Yeah, I do remember you were very hesitant when I first talked to you about it.
Yeah, not so much hesitant. I just think I struggled.
You just didn't get it.
No, I just struggled to find the. I admit I struggled to find at that time. Why would I do this over that?
Right.
So it wasn't that. It was just I was really thinking of it. This is not manufacturing. I don't understand.
Right.
Because all the examples I'd read were like the Starbucks cup, or the.
Oh, okay.
Or when you buy gum at the supermarket, when the little piece of paper says please reorder, and I went, I get that. I don't get how this applies to
software engineering. Yeah.
And that really hadn't been out there. So that was my hassle with it. But I mean, I gave a talk on it in 2009, I think, when I went to the Atlassian Summit. I look back on that, and if you can find that in the deep dark of the internet and you want to waste an hour of nothing better, go watch that. But it was about how to do it in Jira. But again, I remember going to that conference and people...
Wow.
Not really being aware of it.
Okay.
So that was probably my first foray into it. But honestly, I wasn't really still using it for much in those early days. It wasn't until...
So back to certification.
Yes. How we got down there was we were talking about how we got our CSNs.
I think a lot of organisations are going down the scale path. I think maybe having a scaled would be useful. That said, I'm a personal advocate of build your own scale method, and there's no course right now on build your own scale method, so maybe I can add that to my book list of things I need to write about.
But that said, I mean, let's take whether we like or lump Safe or Less or Nexus or
Dad
or any of those things just for a moment.
Mm.
The actual content that's actually inside.
There's a lot of freely available content.
Well, freely available, and in fact, even the things that are on the course, on the courseware, is actually very good. It's you learn lots of things. I mean, you know, things like wait a shorter job first. Now Safe's brought in, the whole, CapEx versus OpEx type.
Lean principles as well.
Type thing. Yep. Yeah, lean principles are in there, the basis. So if you go in not thinking about this as being like... PMI or Prince 2, and you just go and say, this is a bunch of techniques to learn, I actually think there's probably a lot of value.
Yeah, however, if I looked at it differently about build your own, that the sort of thought going back to our initial comment would be, how can you have business agility? And to me it would be, a lot of those lean principles are definitely worthwhile, but I don't think we ask the right questions.
So I'll come back to build your own in a moment. That's what I parked this up, park that over there for just a moment, because that's another question in our mailbag that I just made up. But to be a mailbag episode, I have to make mailbag stuff up. But to finish off on the certification thing, so CSM is one of those things that if you've never seen Scrum before, I think it's a perfectly valid course to go do. Or as you say, summarising what you said, is if you want that certification on your resume, right, it's probably the one out of all of them that stands out.
I agree. Yep. I do like the IC Agile pathway stuff. I think there's, from a role-specific perspective, if you've got some money to throw to a problem and you don't want to read some books and you've got some free days, I like that pathway.
I think that's the same for all certifications, though. I mean, we just talk about where to start with Agile, right? You do CSM, we can do your own reading. If you want to, I mean, you can go read Leffingwell's book and go read the Safe website, and you probably have a pretty good leg up on what you need to do in order to scale. Yeah,
that's true.
But I agree with you. I mean, I'm an advocate for the IC Agile pathways in that I do like those learning objectives that are continually evolving and are written by people in the community. Which I think are good, and the fact that the pathways take you down a skill set, not necessarily a role.
Yeah, yeah. So capabilities rather than role. Right. Yep, yep.
And they're continually evolving. For Scrum Master, to come back to the original question from the mailbag, is where does the Scrum Master go? So yes, the IC Agile path is one as well. And then you do have special providers, like you do have people like the Agile Coaching Institute, which actually the beginning of their courseware does go down the IC Agile pathway anyway, but then back things up with coaching and mentoring and their whole viewpoint of the world. Also stacks you there. But I think at the end of the day, when you talk about moving from shoe to ha, which is really where Scrum Masters kind of sit, is that ha level, there's no substitute for just barreling in there and
doing the switch, doing the 70 out of the 70 20 10.
And getting your hands dirty and making some mistakes, because I think the thing that most people get really hung up with when they become a Scrum Master is that they feel that their job is that they have to be able to tell the team. And that's not what coaching is about. Coaching is about helping the team realize the issues or the problems that they're facing, and helping them, particularly when you're about team coaching, you're not enterprise coaching, which is what a Scrum Master is at. At that team coaching level, it's about the team actually figuring the way through it. And so the only skills you need are really the things when you do need to reach into that little bag and go, actually, let's go and find something else out of here.
And one of the things, and I agree with that, the concern that I have is, when you have leaders who are probably, in fairness and quite often, less educated than the grassroots teams who are applying Agile, it's interesting to me, the Scrum Master is the conduit that has to deal with the old system and the new system. And I see them often being severely torn as a result of that. And I don't know how we can fix that other than educating at the leadership level better. And I do think that's something that we as a community need to do. I don't think there's an adequate amount of content out there that helps leaders understand what their new role is inside of an Agile environment.
Mm. Although we are starting to see that as now we're seeing more courses come out around business agility.
Yep.
You're starting to see, we've always had the business text. You've always had the Steve Dennings of the world who have been... starting to push the mindset change.
Yeah, the mindset change is important, but what I think's missing today is the very tactical what I do on a day-to-day basis.
So things like Management 3.0was kind of a starting point to that, I think. Particularly, as I've talked about, I'm sure I've talked about the podcast before, is the workshops behind it, not necessarily the book. But some of the workshop techniques, that's now in the book, that whole the workshop techniques. And then you start to look at some of the new books, for example, Sandy Mamoli and David Moll's book about self-organizing teams, which is a leadership. That's really about leadership, actually saying, no, instead of us sitting in a boardroom and deciding that Renee is now going to go and sit in this team, opening up to the team and sorting themselves. So they're the type of techniques that are starting to flow out, and that's where a lot of the interesting things are happening. And as you alluded to before, things like 70-20-10, yes, you need to apply learning, but you need to also give people the space to, the slack in the process to...
Oh,
the
slack is a huge issue. So almost everywhere I see it as a problem that people aren't given the space to learn and to think about their learning as it applies in that 70% zone. So 70% being on the job. Now, in fairness, whilst we do talk about 70-20-10, that was a management study based upon managers. I'm not entirely sure if it is the right applicable number for the space of software developers.
Yeah, I agree there. The numbers, I probably need to tweak a little bit, but it's a good starting point.
Yeah.
So, the conclusion to the person who's looking for mailbag, who's looking for certification, yes.
Yes.
Lots of options.
Yes, do it. Lots
of options. There's no right or wrong answer. I think the other thing we haven't mentioned is community. That's the big thing. Getting into the community, whether it's by listening to things like this and talking to other people, whether it's going to local meetups, whether it's going to local conferences, international conferences, because that's where you really learn a lot of those things.
Which is that 20.
Yeah.
Interestingly, one other thing that I'd be suggesting is starting to get a mentor. I don't think we do a lot of it. We have people who talk in the community. You have a lot of support groups, but you don't have a person that you can regularly actually talk through problems on. And whilst a lot of organisations do have coaches, if you don't have a coach in your organisation, it's probably worthwhile to have someone who's outside of your organisation who can help mentor you through some of the harder bits as a Scrum Master, so that when you get into that sticky problem of top down, squish zone that you've got someone to help support you through that.
Do you think problem people have a, and you've had some first-hand experience with this, do you think people have a problem with putting their hand in their pocket to, you know, to request that service? Because when you think about, when you think about agile coaches, people who have traditionally done that, people like yourself, you're in the organisation.
Yeah.
But a lot of things that you and I have both struggled with in recent organisations we've worked in is trying to get to that executive layer and, you know, even just, you know, be there and say, hey, let's just sit down for an hour and talk about stuff.
Yeah.
You know, trying to see the value in that. And if you are a scrum master, you know, like our mailbag person is, sometimes actually, you know, organising with someone to actually, you know, spend that time could be the best investment you actually make.
Yeah, exactly.
Mm. Interesting. All right. I want to go away from the mailbag for just a minute. I want to come back to building your own scale framework, because that's an interesting concept that kind of flew by there. And something I know you've been, that's something you proposed for recent Agile conferences. And
yeah, and something that I did also recently start to work on at a leadership level as well. So when leaders were starting to ask questions around what does Agile mean for us and how does this look operationally for us, certainly the teams can work in a very agile way, but what does that mean from a leadership perspective? So I started...
Is scale the right word there, though?
No, not necessarily. So it's interesting.
Because as you explained that, that's got nothing to do with scale, in my opinion.
No. It's interesting.
You're just trying to cash in.
No, okay, maybe. and I think you're right. In some ways, when I started thinking through the problem, it wasn't just scale. So the way in which I started to think about it, like if you're going to sort of, it was a little bit like a holacracy sort of view of how do we build our system, but not going as extreme as holacracy is of that. So it's probably a good middle ground between teams that used to be quite waterfall, who are wanting to go into an agile environment, but aren't quite ready for holacracy. So that whole orange to green to teal, but which is in organizing, reorganizing, reinventing organizations.
Got it third time. Yeah.
Thank you. So the approach that I took was looking at the sort of things that we need to handle. And it was a whole pile of questions that I started to build. So I don't have them on me, so I'm just going to have to run it off from a month ago off the top of my head. So things like, how do we ensure that we have quality? How do we know that
people?
But yeah, there's a number of people ones, but that our people are capable, or how do we grow our capability of our people, or how do we know that our work is going to realize the benefits that we're expecting it to do? So just a whole pile of these questions, and was a whole pile of questions for delivery teams, for operational teams, for managing people, for managing environments, and it was ended up being a list of I think around about 50 different questions. And then taking those cards, effectively I wrote them up as cards, and then I did a sort of a viewpoint or a lens on it to say, right, do we need to do this for an individual? Yes or no? Do we need to do this at a team level? Do we need to do this at a like a department or a scaled or whatever level? Do we need to do this as a leadership team? Do we need to do this with the business or with suppliers? And looking all the different possible stakeholder groups, effectively, is what it was.
Were they really clear cut? I would have thought a lot most of those would be cross-cutting.
Yeah. So the answer was, in some cases, we need to do it for this group and this group, or we need to do it for these three, or we just do it for this one. And so we created this sort of matrix of, okay, we need to handle this. We need to have an answer to this question for this group of people. And then you multiply out those question cards for each one of those groups, so you end up potentially with a list of maybe 70 or 80 different cards as a result of that. And then the question is, right, do we really need to handle all of this as an organisation? Are these all the things that we have to absolutely do? Is some of the stuff minimal viable organisation? And then cut some of that, effectively, meetings out of the organisation. And then say, okay, now that we've got this list, these are the things that we should care about and we should always keep our eye and our focus on. How are we going to do this? And you start to gather up the cards together and say, okay, we're going to do this together in this one lump. And these four things we're going to handle in this one meeting, and we're going to do it once every 4 weeks. So they're working out the operational cadence based upon the problems or the goals of the organization, not based upon any framework that's out there.
Hmm.
And so it was really building the cadence across the organization using it.
Isn't that the point, though? I mean, if you... Yeah, something like, I'm not going to pick one safe, but let's just pick, I'll pick less as something just different, but it doesn't matter which one we pick here. That's going to suit, right? That suited Nokia, because that's what it was built from. And probably suits organisations that fit that same mold. And so there are some organisations, right, where I'm sure people like Baz and others go into, some where they force it in there because it's what they know, and some where it just naturally fits. And the same goes for Scrum, the same goes for XP, the same goes for Safe, same goes for all these sort of frameworks, that if the culture and the organisation and where they are in their journey fits, the thing fits in. But as we find with most people who adopt Agile, it's about finding how it fits into your team, right? You'll pick up Scrum, and then they go, yeah, well, we're doing Scrum and. We're doing this, but... and we want this thing to build on there. And so a good Agile team is one that actually has continuously improved and evolved their own framework, so to speak.
Yeah.
So is it the education of saying, you know, which is the whole reason that, and if Tony was here, he'd be on his high horse about the Scaled Agile framework, as he normally is, so I'll channel him for a moment. But it's not the right thing for everybody. Pick it up and go, this is a one-size-fits-all.
Yeah, and in fairness, Safe does say, look, if these things aren't relevant to you, take them out.
Which people never read.
Which they don't read. And I think this is why I sort of like this approach, because it's conscious and deliberate intent.
Hmm.
It's consciously working out these are the things that we need, that we care about, and you prioritise them. So to Locracy's point about knowing what the priorities are, that this takes precedence over this meeting so that there's clarity around that. And it really, to me, more importantly than anything else, gives the power back to the organisation to use whatever they need, whatever framework, whatever technique, whatever practice, to get the outcome that they want. And one of those cards, just to be clear, is how often we refine this list of things.
Mm-hmm.
So how often we meet as a group, who's in that group, and how do we do that? Because I think that's really probably one of the most important cards in there.
Mm.
Because in organisations, you're just always applying in these frameworks, and you're not actually consciously taking a step back in a lot of cases and go, is this framework meeting our needs? And who's the group, who's the governing group that has ownership to say, yes, this is meeting our needs? And what are the measures of that?
Interesting. I have more things in our mailbox, but this will become a very long podcast and the number of M&Ms are slowly declining.
That's not too bad. I'm only having like a dozen, maybe.
You want to do one more?
Sure.
All right, one more. This is the last one we have in the mailbag.
Okay.
For now. Although I'm very bad at reading my email sometimes. This is a question I had from business analysts recently, and I want to understand your answer, and I'll come back to my answer as part of this, because this is actually something I haven't been able to find in any of the Scrum books anywhere.
Mm.
So we've got a traditional organization doing sprints, right? So let's just call it,
textbook Scrum.
Textbook Scrum, yep. For want of a better term. And we have some textbook business analysts in this organization, and this organization has some wicked problems. It's a large bureaucratic engine, in large enterprises we've kind of alluded to before, where if you want to make a change to something, you need to probably go and talk to 7,000 people and get their ideas, which used to be a big document that would get signed off by all 7,000 people and take 6 months. It's not clear-cut, right? A requirement comes down and it's not clear-cut because there are implications to different areas of the organization when a team picks it up to evolve the system. And so one of the things that this team has been working on is moving to the more three amigos type idea.
Mm-hmm.
So leaving the conversation, the story card conversation, to the last responsible moment. So we have a backlog, that backlog gets turned into a sprint backlog, and then we pick the story up. The problem is that in order to be the customer or the three amigo who comes to the conversation when the developer and tester are ready to pick up, the business analyst is a job that always has to have done some pre-work. Same with the customer.
Mm-hmm.
If you've got to do that, there is work that has to happen outside the sprint.
The tick to the tock, yep.
Yes. So we talk about the sprint cadence, right, often being about the analysis that is done in conjunction with the developer and testing and moving the story through to done. But there is the stuff, that the pre-work that has to be done, that's taken what was essentially a three-line story card to now a whole bunch of analysis that is ready to then, in discussion, be turned into requirements. And so the problem they've been grappling with is, where do we visualize that work? How do we account for that work? How do we know that we're spending just enough time on the analysis and not getting sucked into it? Are we spending the right time with the team? And that's something I've been grappling with as a team, but I'm interested in your viewpoint on that. Because where I'll go to this is, traditionally we've always had, when I think back to my early Agile training, we've always had the story wall that's had the to-do, analysis, development, test done. And as we've moved towards more Kanban type approaches, where we try to limit those swim lanes and move to more of a in progress type model, in order to get the story, the cycle time across the wall a lot quicker, and reducing those handoffs between the roles, with the whole Three Amigos idea, the analyst still has to do some readiness, and quite often that has to be before the sprint they come into. How do they visualize it?
So why does it have to be before the sprint?
Because quite often it's a blocker if it would be in the sprint. As soon as you come to the discussion, there would be 37 questions, of which 12 people want to stick their nose into it about. And
so it's certainly a common problem that I see, where a lot of teams certainly make that remark around, it's going to be a blocker if we try and do it inside of the sprint. And to the fact that, a time box or a sprint is meant to be at the start, you have nothing in progress, and at the end you should have everything done. And so the risk that you run by doing pure Scrum by the textbook is that you have a whole pile of people effectively potentially twiddling their fingers whilst they wait for those requirements to be done.
One of the requirements to be done, but the investigation to be able to to have the conversation in order to build.
To be clear, in my head, I meant requirements analysis as an activity.
I know, I'm just being clear to the people listening.
And it was interesting. What, 5 years ago, we commonly.
Do you not like blue M&Ms? You pick up that blue M&M and throw it back in the bag at least 7 times, right?
So 5 years ago, we often saw this thing where you had this sprint plus or minus one, where you have the analytical capabilities being worked on a sprint in advance of the rest of the team. And effectively, really, if you've got a 2-week sprint, really, in essence, when you're doing this plus or minus one, you've got a 4-week sprint.
That's right.
you just don't do a 2-week sprint. Do a 4-week sprint, seriously.
Or from a large vendor who I won't name, but has a couple of letters in their acronym, said to me, we do 8-week sprints.
Right. So call it what it is. Your sprint length is longer than really what it is, and otherwise you are working on inventory. You've got inventory in system that you're actually not recognizing, and you're creating huge context switching inside of the team itself. Recently, in fact, today, I saw this on a monumental scale in safe implementations, where teams were working whole product increments in advance. And when I got down into it, I found out they were working not only on the current sprint's work, not only on grooming the future sprint's work, but also grooming the next PI's worth of work. And I just looked at it and thought, this is crazy. And I couldn't fathom that really was the design intent behind SAFe in that particular area. And I hate to think that was the intent, because that's three lots of batching and context switching.
Mm.
So how would I fix it?
Mm. Well, and all I'm getting to is exactly what you said there, is that when you start to uncover teams that are struggling, and particularly when you start talking business analysts who are struggling, this has just been coming out to me, particularly in a couple of teams I've been coaching just recently, as one of the big things. And because they're still hamstrung by what we were talking about earlier in the podcast, which is the business hasn't reached agility yet. If the business has reached agility, this wouldn't be such a problem. So it's this growing pain that you have to go through in order to you know, on the start of your journey, and should become less of a thing as the business becomes more agile.
So my two recommendations to fix it, one would be extend your sprint length. Don't do it outside of the sprint. Try and the second one would be really focusing more on Kanban and flow. And what I mean by that is, in the last year, Kanban's significantly changed. So if you haven't had a look at it, it's worthwhile having a look at a lot of the different slides set up on David Anderson's website on SlideShare. A lot of great content. And in particular, the content that I'm referring to is this splitting of commitment and time of, yes, we know this work well enough to be able to commit to it. And this splitting of this feeding paradigm going through the front end of it. You can't see me waving my hands around, but in essence, there's this board is split into two. And traditionally, the sprint board is that commitment point onwards, but the pre-element is that analytical work. And they describe the commitment point as a pull point, and everything up to that point being a push through the system.
Hmm. And actually, that's exactly the without having seen that particular slide deck, which made me bring up my laptop just before the talk. That's exactly the scenario I started them down the point of, is that we need to visualize that work, and essentially what we're doing is we're pushing this to the top of the next sprint backlog, and visualizing it. And realizing that that's work that we're doing on, even though it's not the work that we're committing to the product owner, we're going to show it to them in the next sprint.
Yeah.
But it's interesting. It's just been interesting to me that as I went sort of looking in lots of books for something to validate.
I agree. It's not covered in anything other than, I think, through some of the Kanban content.
Because there is this assumption that there's this whole idea that you just bring something into the sprint, and probably through co-located teams, probably through a knowledgeable product owner or subject matter expert, that you will have, this whole idea of having the pizza team, type idea, that you'll have everybody you need in the team. And if we were building if you and I were sitting here and building a brand new, Web 2.0 app, or Web 2.0, geez, I'm showing my age. If we're building some new mobile app, I don't know where that came from, it's late.
A microservice.
Yeah, sure, yeah, that's cool. That's what cool kids talk about. We're building a new app, right, in order to make ourselves millions of dollars, we would have the ideas in this room, because that's what we need. But when you get to these large enterprises where, in the case I'm talking about, it's legislative change, where there are so many different moving parts and everybody's got a different opinion, or as I've seen in financial and insurance organizations, where there are just so many different channels and different parts of the organization that have their part to play, the business analyst's job often is to try and extract those along. The product owner brings the problem to the team, where they want the product to go. But in order to actually make sure that you're keeping the rest of the large organization working, in other words, you're not going to screw up something in the finance area, you're not going to screw up something in the in the procurement area, they have to go and find the answers to all those things. There you go. That's our mailbag.
Great.
Excellent.
I think we're at time, right?
After 100 something episodes, we finally got through some mail. There we go. So the last thing we talk about is just what's on your reading list at the moment, Renee? What are you reading right now?
I've been reading an awful lot about climate change.
Okay.
Oh, you probably don't want to talk about that. However,
if it's got some remote,
it does. It does. It's really inspired me to do an agile and climate change talk.
Okay.
So I'm thinking about what that looks like. But in essence, in my head, it talks about there's some systems thinking in there, root cause analysis in there, the whole build, measure, learn as it applies and relates to climate change.
It's pretty hard when you learn on climate change, though. You kind of, to a certain extent, got to build and measure, don't you? Learning sometimes a bit too late.
Yeah, and that's where I'm worried. Yeah.
We're learning about those things now.
Yeah, so I think if you get the very short version of this is, I'm really concerned around our ability as a society of people who have mindsets. That I don't think our mindsets are shifting fast enough to be able to deal with the problem.
Mm-hmm.
And where I see agile fitting in is certainly in that reinventing organisations. It's moving those mindsets from having that command and control to more of that collaborative base, that in systems thinking base. And I think the more people that we shift towards agile, the more we'll have the right mindset inside of people to be able to deal with this problem. And that's the crux of the talk.
And I think it's really, you know, if you go back to, and we've talked about this on the podcast before, as you talk, you talk to people like Luke Homan, for example, and the types of things he's talking about using our experience to solve wicked problems.
Yeah, yeah.
Because everything we've just talked about for the last 56 minutes is really minuscule in the scheme of things.
Yeah.
You know, whilst it's important from the organisations that we work to, in the case of leaving a better planet behind for our children and the like, it's, who really cares?
Yeah. Anyway, so my favourite book on all of this, because I've read many in the last few months, is Naomi Klein's This Changed Everything. This Changes Everything.
Okay. And can you see an agile mindset in that book?
In her thinking? Yeah. Oh, yeah, without a doubt. Yeah, very collaborative-based thinker, group thinker. Yeah, yeah.
Is there anything you can extract out from that, just being an agile coach, when you take that back to work?
There's some ideas and thoughts that I've had associated with that. So to me, probably the biggest one is transparency. No one recognises, this is not a widely recognised problem to the degree of significance that it should be, because lack of transparency. So there's a lot of issues around suppression of information due to the alignment of a lot of that 1% of people who control the media empires of the world. So I think one of the biggest deals is trying to get transparency in some way across the world.
Interesting. Well, that doesn't make my pick kind of really boring. I've been going back reading about improv. So I picked up when we were at the Agile conference, we saw the lady's name, who I can never remember with the hard to pronounce surname, who did the keynote on improv. Go back to our Agile conference notes. But she wrote a book with somebody else whose name is also escapes me, called Control Shift, which I originally picked up thinking of it as an improv book, but actually it's a really interesting little kind of, change your mindset book. And I'm not all the way through it yet, but there's a whole bunch of little tricks and techniques in there that can solve, and I think it'd be a good book really for leaders. It's a good book for anybody, but particularly for leaders who are struggling to kind of make that mindset change that we were talking about before, about looking from things in a different way. And the book's essentially then full of 50... They refer to them as games, but some of them are just
team things,
or even just personal techniques. Things that you can go and do in order to think differently. And what I've been doing is I've been reading. I've been trying to extract things out to go, is this something I can do differently with a team?
I want to say Schumer. I don't know if that was the right name, but something like Schumer, I think
it was. Yes. Anyway, we'll put a link to the post to the show notes. But I think the one I've taken out of that there's one little game in there, which is a take an everyday. I can't remember the name of the game, but it's take an everyday object like a vacuum cleaner,
like a microphone.
Or a microphone that I'm holding in my hand, and list out, try and explain that particular object to somebody who's never seen it before. Like, go back if you're in the 1930s and explain it. And then pull the thing apart. Talk about all things about why it wouldn't work. Right? So change your mindset to kind of pull that apart. And then flip your mindset and then sort of try to extract it back together and try and say all the things about what makes this thing really awesome.
Isn't that Black Hat?
Sort of, yeah.
Right, okay.
But what you actually find from that is that our list of being able to poke holes in something is a lot longer than the positives we can take out of it. But if you take something like the microphone I'm holding or a vacuum cleaner, they're products that people had to grapple with those questions with in the first place.
Right? Yeah.
You know, vacuum cleaner, it's stupid. No one will ever push a big machine around no one will ever expect a little robot running around in there, into their furniture or all those types of things you can come up with for a vacuum cleaner being not good. But yet we couldn't live life without them. So people have had to overcome those challenges in order to fix it. And I think that's something when you talk to teams who are trying to go down the agile path is exactly the same problem, right? It's full of all the reasons why this can't work. Right? It's changing the mindset to why it can.
There's some movie, I can't even remember now, about the smartphone. I just remember this huge brick. I've taken this phone. Oh, there was a camera. It was a phone and a camera. What was that from? I can't even remember anymore. It was a comedy of some sort.
Quite possibly.
Anyway.
And on that note, Renee, if they want to know more about you, where do they find you on the interwebs?
Renee at theagilerevolution.com or something like that.
Yeah, that's the one, or on Twitter at theagilepodcast. Where they find all your writing? Because you've been writing about some of the things you're talking about today on your blog.
Yeah, they can find me at agileforest.com, and hopefully I might... Oh, I have been thinking for a while for posting up the whole build your own agile scale whatever framework. I don't know what to call it, but yeah.
We'll look out for it at a conference coming soon near you somewhere, if it gets accepted.
No, it did not.
Not at the last thing you posted, but I think with some rewording it'll probably work. You can find me at Craig at theagilerevolution.com and Tony at Tony at theagilerevolution.com. So
Tony at notonthispodcast.com.
That's exactly right. Been great catching up with you, Renee.
Thank you.
Hopefully this one makes it to you in the next 14 months somewhere. but until next time, do you have one thing to say?
Viva la revolution.